Pseudopod, episode 185, March 12th, 2010. This week's story, Charlie Harmer Looks Back, by Brendan Detzner. Hello, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I'm Alistair, your homie made of foamy, and this week's episode comes to us from Brendan Detzner. Brendan has been here before, has had work published in Chaizine, and also has work in the Book of Dead Things anthology, where Mr. Harmer also makes another appearance. Your narrator this week is Eric Luke of the just splendidly titled ExtrudingAmerica.com, so buckle up and get ready to dance. Just remember what they do to horses as we tell you this story, which, I assure you, is true.
Charlie Harmer Looks Back, by Brendan Detzner. 1. It all starts again, and I'm sitting across from Margie in Jack's restaurant. It's late, maybe 2 o'clock in the morning, which might not seem so crazy to you, but this was Milwaukee, not New York or Paris or someplace, and even in New York or Paris, 2 o'clock used to be a lot later than it is now. I don't think you could be out as late as me and Margie were that night. Not anymore. This place is a refuge, and not just because there aren't any other customers. Any two people that wanted to sit together in Jack's restaurant, that was fine with Jack. He had a shotgun under the counter for anybody that wanted to argue with him. I never found out why he was like that. You'd never know it looking at him. He was an old guy, not some kind of radical. He was bald and wore a white smock all the time. Just a guy, like you see everywhere. Even in an empty restaurant with friendly management, we're sitting all the way in the back. We don't even notice. Hiding comes naturally to both of us. I'm making her laugh. She's nervous being out so late, being alone with me. But I'm making her feel better. I'm doing a good job. Talking to her, I don't even see her. Not really. I'm thinking about her sister, thanking me. Seeing me in a new light, in her gratitude. Thinking about me the way I think about her, I fantasize. There are few limits to the things I think about her saying or doing, even sitting across the table from her little sister in a restaurant. At some point, I compliment her latest record, her first record. She blushes. She tells me that it was just an experiment, a silly little thing. She's happy to back up her sister. She loves being a bluebird. I make fun of her loyalty, a little bit, but not too much. I find the line, and I walk right on it. My special talent. She's still laughing. I pay for the meal. There's no alternative. It's just what a man did. And we leave. And from the moment we leave our safe haven, everything becomes uncertain. We're not far from where she lives. It's maybe a 20-minute walk. I should take that walk with her. But at the same time, our late night is on the verge of becoming early morning, and we're not in Jack's restaurant anymore. I want to be her knight in shining armor. On the other side of the scale is reality, and the hundreds of pairs of eyes between here and there. She makes it easy on me. She's leaning away, separating, saying goodbye. I am simultaneously relieved and insulted. I'm still projecting myself into the future, thinking about what Big Sister is going to think. That's what's on my mind when little Margie kisses me on the cheek. I try and figure out what the hell just happened. She walks away and is gone. The dream goes back the way it came, a swinging pendulum. I'm back inside the restaurant, and the whole thing starts again, like it's been doing for a long time, like it probably always will. This is it, my place in the grand scheme of things. Sometimes I get a little time off. 2. The dream fades away. The boss is coming. She graciously gives me time to collect myself. We're in some kind of lounge. Everything is upholstered with vertical stripes, and there are flaming torches on the walls. The boss is not big on context sometimes. I don't hold it against her. She's a busy lady. It's really warm in here. The smell of sulfur fills the air and vanishes, and she's sitting in front of me. She's wearing a red dress. She has long, sumptuous brown hair. You want to go swimming in it. You imagine it cool against your skin, like water. "You're staring, Charlie," she says. "I'm sorry, I can't help myself. I didn't think I'd have the chance to see you again. I had a regular job not too long ago, but I did something I shouldn't have and lost it. She fired me, but never got upset. She's never all that surprised when people do things they shouldn't. You must have known it would happen sooner or later. I don't know anything for sure, beautiful. All I can do is hope. I smile and she smiles back. We talk for a while. She's got a lot on her mind, work stuff. I don't know why she tells me things. I guess it makes her feel better, the same way it makes anybody feel better to get something off their chest. She finally gets around to it. There's something I was hoping you could do for me. Anything you need. I'm grateful you would ask after last time. This is just a small favor, a chance to pick yourself back up. She tells me what the favor is. I'm surprised. Well, that's a little more personal than I'm used to. If you'd rather not do it, I understand. My only alternative to not doing what she asks is going back where I came from. The boss is far beyond having to threaten people to get what she wants. Not at all, I say. I'd be happy to. It feels like I'm falling. 3. I'm dropped off on a street corner. It's nighttime. The sky overhead has a gentle orange glow that swallows the stars. The houses stand apart from each other, but there's not much space in between them. No driveways. The lots are deeper than they are wide. I glance over the picket fences as I walk north and see birdbaths, fountains, rock gardens, flower arrangements, carefully arranged little stone paths, one private world after another. I hear a preacher's voice booming from a couple of blocks away. It bounces off the surrounding buildings. I can only make out every other word of what he's saying. To the side of the twin front doors of the church is a faded metal plaque. Pinned to the wall above them with bungee cords is a white tarp with giant block letters announcing the new name of the mission and what times services are held. I pause for a second to admire the performance. I wonder what would happen if I tried to go inside. A stray cat limps nervously across the street as I reach the end of the neighborhood. I'm faced with a four-lane road that's mostly empty of traffic. On the other side is a giant strip mall with a grocery store and shops, and a couple of those big box places where you can buy anything. A giant parking lot stretches out far and deep, left and right. I turn my head and see my destination, a fortress in red neon. It's actually smaller than the buildings surrounding it, but by night it seems to tower over everything. As I get closer, I see more of the restaurant. It's in the style of Jack's old place, but nothing actually like it. Too big, too out in the open. Even this time of night, there's a line of cars leading up to the drive-in window, and a crew of men and women and teenagers in black polo shirts approaching each car and writing down their orders so they can run them straight to the kitchen and keep things moving quickly. I go in, and I don't know what to think. It's no one thing, it's many things, stacked on top of each other. It's crowded and it's loud. There are posters from old movies on the walls hanging next to autographed pictures of nominally famous people on the walls. There are records hanging from the ceiling, little 7-inch singles printed on transparent red vinyl. There's a jukebox next to the door, but it's only a decoration. It doesn't work. A Temptation song is playing over the PA. It's like somebody threw a party amongst the wreckage that had been my life. It's strange, and it's painful, but I'm glad somebody's having a good time. There's a set of 3 parallel lines leading up to the cash register, and a packed crowd filling the open space in the far corner of the room. The people standing behind the cash registers are all black, but the rest of the restaurant is a mix of everything with everything. Teenagers with brightly colored jackets crammed 3 deep into booths, families, couples. I see a pudgy man in a brown suit looking down at a small child, his son, as they wait for their number to get called. Standing behind him is an aggressively skinny black girl in a bright white winter coat with a logo I don't recognize on the collar and a pink cell phone in her ear. She looks around, changing the way the light hits her face, and I realize that she might be a little older than she's dressing. The girl standing behind her is the opposite. Her mouth is a thin horizontal line stretched across her face. She's centered. She looks like someone who's lived, but she's just a kid, part of a trio, the 3 of them whispering to each other in Spanish. One of her friends is glancing back at a boy at the end of the line. He's wearing all black, everything creased and clean and perfect, an oversized baseball cap cocked to one side on top of his head. He is constantly looking, evaluating, thinking, letting everybody know he's thinking. He notices her and switches up just long enough to smile. He's a good-looking guy. I imagine he gets this a lot. I see the kid I'm looking for on the other side of the room. Another teenager, slender but not skinny exactly. He's wearing a pair of pre-faded jeans and a dark blue hooded sweatshirt. His hair shines. He works at it. I want to say that he's Mexican, but I can't claim to be sure. What's funny is that there's something about him that seems British to me. Like skinny rock and roll British. Maybe his nose. It makes him look like Roger Daltrey. One of the girls behind the counter calls out his number, and he picks up his Italian beef. He sits down at an empty booth and unwraps his sandwich, but he doesn't eat. He just looks at it. There's something on his mind. I sit down. It takes a second for him to notice. I'm eating alone. Not loud, not being a tough guy, just saying it. I snap my fingers. The music stops, and a new song starts playing. There's a woman singing softly over a rhythm section. A piano sneaks in sideways. No one notices the change except him. He takes a closer look at me, at my face. But there is no face. You seem like a nice guy that's thinking about doing something that would surprise people, I say. She's still singing. Her voice is innocent, sounding out each note the best way she knows how, and simultaneously drenched in sex. She knows something deeper than the words, but she doubts you'll ever be worthy of knowing what it is. I snap my fingers again. All activity ceases. Every single person in the restaurant stops what they're doing and stares into space. People from the line turn in the direction of our booth and move forward, stepping on stage. The man in the brown suit and the woman in the white coat and the girl that's too serious for her age and the boy in the hat. The woman singing this song right now was named Beverly Blue. When I first met her, I was a disc jockey at a radio station in Milwaukee. The girl becomes somebody else. Her carriage changes. She doesn't have to be defensive anymore. She's royalty. She's King Kong in a cocktail dress and high heels. The group she was in was called the Bluebells. She was the big deal in the group. Her little sister backed her up, along with another girl they kept replacing. The woman in the white coat changes too, but draws less attention to herself, the little beat coming after the big one. She's young again, and it's less fun than she remembers. She's a mouse. She shrinks. Beverly and her sister and her boyfriend all lived together in a house on the opposite side of town from where I lived. Her boyfriend was their manager. Their everything, really. The man in the brown suit comes back to life. Something rises up inside him, something that had long since been burned away by long years of fidelity and devotion to his children, if he'd ever had it at all. Everything that he looks at, it seems possible that he might want to eat alive, and yet he is polite in his way, stylish. You want him to like you, even against your better judgment. My father owned a little independent label, along with a couple of record stores and a recording studio. The kid with the baseball cap has become my father, but has done so without announcing himself, which was my father's style. None of it ever made him much real money, but that was never the point. He rented jukeboxes to people, too. If you wanted your bar to stay open, you rented a jukebox from my father and paid whatever he told you the price was. That's how I thought of him. He was the jukebox guy. The four of them move into the open space by the front door. The other customers sleepwalk out of the way, pressing against each other to make room. The kid with the big nose watches. He is appropriately scared out of his wits. I don't know exactly how it is that the Bluebells came to record on my father's label. Money probably changed hands. More than that, I'm not sure about. I was there when they first recorded. My dad wanted me there. He didn't trust his own taste in music as much as he did mine. This time, he didn't really need me. We both knew what he had. They take position on the floor. My dad on one side, the Bluebells on the other, standing behind their manager as he makes his pitch. Beverly sly and smiling, and Marjorie scared and wrapped up in herself like a raccoon in a hole. My father listens, evaluating every word carefully, but still relaxed, not really throwing his whole self into it. This is a hobby, something he does to relax. Beverly leans forward and opens her mouth, moving her lips in time with the music into a microphone that isn't there. Her boyfriend moves to the side with the others, smiling, satisfied. My father is standing next to him. Margie is standing by herself in the corner, staring into the booth, jealous, afraid. We could have run into trouble getting it on the radio, but Dad owned the radio. We could have had trouble getting it in stores, but nobody running a record store was going to argue with my father if he had a record he wanted them to carry. So it got heard, and it was a hit. But it was just a local hit, the kind of hit we'd had before. Beverly's boyfriend leans over and whispers in my father's ear. This song wanted to be more than that. It wanted to be national. But making that happen wasn't going to be such an easy thing from a business point of view. The four of them sat down cross-legged on the floor. No chairs, no dinner tables, no plates, no silverware. Only ghosts. They moved like marionettes, their hands lowering to the floor and rising up to their mouths. That was when I really got to know Beverly. When my father went into business with someone in a partner's kind of way, he always really wanted them to feel like family. He didn't have it in him to trust anybody he hadn't cooked a meal for. The others get up and move off stage, except for Beverly, who stays where she is. She stares blankly into space. Her song is still playing. I fell for her pretty hard. At the time, I wasn't really able to admit it to myself. You've got to understand, just having them over for dinner was enough to get people talking behind my father's back. That was how things were. And I was not a brave man. But it's easy to see, in hindsight. She really was gorgeous. Beverly stands up and moves back. My father steps forward and sits down where she just was. He's whispering into the phone the way another man would yell. His eyes have shrunk down into dull metal points. He is very, very upset. He gets up and Beverly walks back into the center of the open space. She starts talking, but there's no voice, only her lips moving. She's looking at you. You're the one she wants. That thing you were hoping for, that you would never admit to anyone, that you embarrassed yourself just daydreaming about, is happening right now, right before your eyes. One of the problems with getting a national hit was getting national distribution. There was no good way to do it. You could get a deal with one big distributor and hope it decided to pay you what it said it was going to pay you. Or you could run around and line up a bunch of little distributors and hope half of them gave you what you needed to pay your lawyers and sue the other half. My dad wasn't really used to getting pushed around, so he went with one of the big companies. Somehow he got pushed around anyway. Why he didn't go to war over that, what kind of leverage they had, I don't know. But they weren't going to pay up until we had another hit on the same level as the first one. While that was going on, Beverly approached me asking to borrow some money. She owed somebody, and she didn't want my dad to know about it. But she said that she knew I'd understand. Doesn't sound like much, but I had an overactive imagination. I thought it meant more than it did. Her face goes blank. She takes a step back, and the stage is empty. They dropped off the face of the earth, all three of them. They got an offer from another label in New York and decided to make a break for it. My money got them a new car and some gas. Beverly and her agent step forward again. They kneel down on the floor and put their hands behind their backs. They look up and start crying. Beverly's boyfriend begs for mercy. They didn't make it that far. My dad pulled me to the side a couple of weeks later and told me that his people had found them. It was just a whisper in my ear, more than I usually ever got to hear about my father's business. But I wanted even more than that. I wanted to pull the trigger. The music stops. Beverly's boyfriend's head kicks back, and his body slumps over. Beverly screams. As far as he was concerned, Beverly hadn't done anything wrong. Or if she had, he was willing to ignore it. He wanted her to keep singing. But she'd broken my heart. Beverly's head kicks back in exactly the same way. She stops screaming and falls backwards. The music starts up again. My four actors return to their original positions with blank looks on their faces. Everyone in the restaurant suddenly restarts whatever it was they'd been doing before I started telling my story. All was as it had been. My dad loved me. Anything I wanted, he gave me. That's it. That's my story. The boy with the big nose looked over at where I'd put on my show, then back at me. He opened his mouth, but he couldn't put the words together. You want to know if I got away with it, I ask? He nods. I did. As far as anybody else was concerned, Beverly was just one more girl who ran off to make the big time and never came back. He finds his voice sooner than most people would. He's a bold kid. He has something in him. I wonder if anyone's noticed, his parents, his teachers at school, anybody. "You're not telling me the whole story," he says. "I've told you everything I knew at the time I died. Anything else would be speculation. But I do speculate. I'm dead. The way you'll be dead someday. All dead guys do is speculate." I disappear. I'm still there, but he can't see me. He looks around, stares at the woman in the white coat while she continues to wait for her food, and leaves quickly, leaving his tray on the table. I shovel his Italian beef into my mouth. I can feel something warm in my stomach, but the feeling quickly disappears as my surroundings fade away. 4. I'm back in the lounge. The brunette is sitting across from me. "You did an excellent job, Charlie." "I'm glad to hear it. I wasn't sure it was what you were looking for. It's not what I'd expected." "What do you mean?" "Whatever he was planning, it seems like it would be more your line just to let him do it." "Maybe I need him for something later on." "I guess you must." I look down at the floor. This is the difficult part. It's hard to be smooth while you're begging. "Is there anything else you need done? I know you're not going to give me a regular job after last time, but if there's anything small that needs to happen, any little thing..." She's smiling. "Maybe later. Good night, Charlie. Thanks again." And that's it. I'm back in the restaurant with Marjorie. She's talking about the record she just made. It was just an experiment, a silly little thing. She's happy to be a bluebird. I never found out what happened to Marjorie. After my father went to jail, I got another job in radio, a little station in Indianapolis. I don't know if she left town with her sister or if she got left behind. If she stayed in the music business, she either took a different name or was never that big a deal, because I never heard of her again. I don't know what happened inside Margie's head that would cause her to develop a crush on a white guy 10 years older than she was in the United States of America in 1958. I do know that her sister's boyfriend kept both of them pretty securely cooped up, and if she had any family other than her sister, they weren't in the picture. She didn't know very many people. I might have been the only person who was nice to her on a regular basis. I don't know if she knew, or could guess, or even suspected that I had anything to do with her sister's death. And if she did, I don't know what effect that knowledge would have had on her. I don't know what she was left with after the two people who were her life's foundation suddenly disappeared. She kisses me on the cheek and walks away, and everything begins again. I wonder when the boss will need me again. I wonder who the boy with the big nose was and how his plans might have changed. I wonder how long it will be before the brunette summons all of her soldiers, calls in all her favors. I am struck, not for the first time, with the irony of my situation. Praying to the devil for deliverance.
"You met me at a very strange time in my life." That line, that entire scene in Fight Club, is possibly my favorite moment in any film ever. As the barriers collapse inside and outside our sort of hero's head, the film becomes a romantic comedy, a thriller, an action movie, and a horror flick all at once. And a very strange boy, a very strange girl, find some common ground as the world collapses around them and the pixies ask where their mind has gone. It's dead romantic. That dizzying moment, though, the moment where you look back down the ladder and realize how high you are, then hits a lot of people, and seems to hit most of my circle of friends in their early 30s, which we now are. And by we, I mean me. Yes, that's right, younger listeners, I went to the cinema to see movies that were made the year you were born. If you want me, I'll be in the corner, rocking backwards and forwards, humming the theme to Back to the Future Part 3. Anyway, there's a point where suddenly you realise how much information's up there. It happened to me before when I was 21, actually, and I realised that suddenly I'd done stuff. I had backstory. Suddenly I was a character, and for some reason hadn't maxed for decks. My library search was pretty high, but my dex needed to work on. I really must do something about that. But when that moment comes, and believe me, it will, when you look around and you see the hundreds of people you've met, see the friendships and love, and the awful, howling, ghastly mistakes you've made, it's kind of like watching the sort of Gerard Butler movie where he isn't an action hero. You want to look away, and yet you can't. The secret, because it's me, so there must be a secret, right? It's actually pretty simple. You accept it. You look it square in the face and you go, you know what? The hair was awful. I should never under any circumstances have thought I could sing, and the world's stupidest rock climbing incident? How am I still alive? Stare at it, give it edges, examine it, dissect it, make it smaller. Control it. Because otherwise, your past controls you. The past is a country that many of us are trapped in, and really, we should all have exit visas. If you like this story, then please make an author and a bunch of podcasters happy and donate. To us. Other people are good, but I'm talking about us right now. The link is at feedthepod on pseudopod.org, and we rely on you to pay our authors and cover our costs. If you can, and if you can't, don't worry about it. But if you can, please help us. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. And Pseudopod knows that whilst it's a long way to the top if you want to rock and roll, it's a remarkably short distance to the Wii and Guitar Hero.